Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome on this Martin Luther King Day. We're actually taping this program on Martin Luther King's birthday. He will be 81 years old, would have been 81 years old. And I've asked a group of people who I think are thoughtful and who are activists who work in this community to join us to reflect on Martin Luther King's, not just his life really, but reflect on the work of Martin Luther King and its relevancy to the world of the 21st century. To think about what Martin Luther King did when he led at the end the Poor People's Campaign, which was his last act. His last acts were about uniting a cross interracial group of poor working class people in America to march on Washington, D.C., to demand an equal and just society. He began more and more to talk in ways that made him unpopular with many of the people who gave him money from New York City and other places. I will say personally that I was a young man, and I was involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Civic Interest Group here in Baltimore and the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Group in Cambridge, Maryland. There were many of us in those days who felt we were at odds with Martin Luther King, that he wasn't radical enough, that he didn't push hard enough. But then I felt there was kind of a merging of much before he passed, between the years that Malcolm X was assassinated and Martin Luther King was assassinated. Things began to shift. But how is that relevant to today, other than remembering great people of the past? And we're going to talk about that this hour. We're joined in the studio here at Clean Cuts Music and Sound, which is our home base here, where we do much of our recording, where our offices are. We're joined by Dr. Lester Spence, who is professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. You can go up to lesterspence.com and see his writings. You can also hear him right here on WEAA very often on Tell Me More, where he's part of the barbershop. Mina Chun is with us. She's an artist and a writer, interdisciplinary professor at Maryland Institute College of Art. She'll be the keynote speaker for MICO on January the 20th at 2:30 for Unity Day, and she'll be talking on racism. Her latest book is Shamanism in Cyberspace, which I'm in the middle of reading, and she'll be back on to talk about that when I finish it. And we're joined also by Mike McGuire. He was co-founder of Red Emma's Bookstore and Coffee House. He's an activist who works with United Workers and Witness Against Torture and makes his living as a carpenter. So Lester, Mina, Mike, welcome. Good to have you all with us. So I'd like to start by asking kind of your reflections on this day, and especially since we're in the middle of what's going on in Haiti. To me, it's kind of a Bill Quigley, who is a real activist from Katrina and continues with Haiti, has called on President Obama to grant temporary protected status for Haitians, which he said he could do with a stroke of a pen. He writes, President Obama can enact temporary protected status for Haitians with a stroke of a pen. Do it. The U.S. has already done it for El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Sudan, and Somalia. President Obama should do it on Martin Luther King Day. What do we think about that?
I remember
Lester Spence.
When Obama received the Nobel, and when he gave his speech, and he talked about the virtues of nonviolence. And then what he did was he said, listen, I'm a politician, I'm the head of a state, and I don't necessarily have the wherewithal, because I'm the head of state, to be nonviolent. I have to use another. I have to use all the means available to me. I bring that in because there is this idea that politicians have one set of roles and responsibilities, which I think is accurate, while activists have another set of roles and responsibilities. I think this is a case where Obama can bring his values in line with his role as head of state. But I also think, and then this can bring us into a richer discussion about Dr. King, is that it's really incumbent upon us as citizens to push him to bring those values in line, right? Because I don't think he will do it. I don't think Haiti will be more than a blip unless, and we can replace Haiti with Katrina or a number of other catastrophes. They won't be more than blips without sustained pressure placed upon him and other political representatives to create a better world?
For me personally, I'm still stunned and paralyzed at what's happened in Haiti. And one of my friends, Flo McGarrell, actually had died there. And she is actually, before she passed away, it was a he. She had gone through transgender therapy. And
she was a Haitian?
No, American.
American.
And had, you know, been teaching at MICA, was alumni of MICA. And he created a nonprofit organization in Haiti to provide spaces and opportunities for creating artwork. So very brave soul. And so I'm really kind of focused on this kind of personal mourning and condolences to her family. But I'd like to sort of say that it's a kind of paralyzing moment in history, and that in a way we need to pause. This is a very kind of different track than saying, you know, how do we kind of, you know, understand world news? I'd like to actually pause and think of another track that responds to the tragedy. And John Cage, you know, would air 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence on radio, for example. And so what would be this kind of equivalent silence that we could have as a way of mourning? And this is a completely different track than perhaps, you know, what listeners might want, because listeners want solutions and answers. But as a way in which activism could occur, and this is activism with a small a and not a big A, I think it could occur in the most, you know, minute ways. And so owing to this moment, I'd like to actually keep that pause, because I know if I have an immediate response to what's going on, you know, it might be sort of like the response, you know, Lester, that you said Bush after 9/11 said, keep shopping. Okay, so in order not to make the mistake, I'd like to sort of keep it, you know, in a bit of a silence, just for the memory and the mourning.
And we can do that.
There's a lot to be said about Haiti that doesn't have its genesis in the earthquake. There's a lot that Obama should have been doing already, that any seekers of justice should be doing already. The U.S. has been involved in some really grave injustices in Haiti that have helped create a system in which, for example, there's only one hospital in Port-au-Prince, which was left to collapse, which barely had services before the earthquake. There have been trends to try and address justice issues in Haiti, and where the U.S. has played its hand poorly. That is against the role of justice. And I'm thinking specifically about President Aristide and the history of his two ousters as president, and U.S. involvement directly, especially the second time, where it was U.S. military that were surrounding Aristide's compound and forcing him out of the country. Aristide is not the solution for Haiti. I'm just noting it as one way in which the U.S. has been involved in Haiti, which has crushed hope time and again. It's really heartbreaking to think about the earthquake in Haiti. I was there, I guess, 3 years ago on a human rights delegation. And to think of Haiti having more devastation than it did then is kind of hard to imagine.
To think about how much can one country endure. You know, Aristide spoke today on Martin Luther King's birthday from South Africa, saying he wants to come home. Many people in Haiti want him to come home. Mm-hmm. They see him as a king-esque figure in their nation. And he talked about being the first independent free black nation on the planet Earth. And
what Pat Robertson identifies as their pact with the devil.
Well, he would. He would. But I mean, so I think that it's an interesting juxtaposition to think about this day and what is happening in Haiti, you know. So we can wrap that back in to what we've been talking about. I just wanted to raise that first because I think Haiti's in all of our minds, and it's very close in our family as well. But here we are in 2010. And everybody and their mother claims Martin Luther King as their legacy now. He's safe. You know, he's safe. Malcolm X is getting safe. And Che Guevara is on T-shirts and selling ads around the world. So people, after 40 years, 30 years, no matter how radical or revolutionary they were, to push for change, become safe after a while. How do we take him out of the safe zone? How do we take that legacy out of the safe zone and put it where he would be comfortable having it, do you think?
So, Mark, if I may now break the silence.
Yes, please.
You had mentioned in the introduction that Martin Luther King didn't satisfy certain people in New York who were perhaps supporting him, that he wasn't radical enough. And I almost see that in the ways people think that, you know, someone like him wasn't black enough, for example. And that is a stereotype. It's a kind of stereotype that's held on pinning down, how much of blackness is blackness and of a kind of representation that is beyond the everyday activism of a person or everyday activism of a body of people. And now, if people are saying that the image of Martin Luther King is one of comfort, that we are satisfied, I think it's a kind of misleading opportunity in thinking of the comfortableness that could be portrayed in such an important image. And when I say important, I don't mean that it's a kind of blind image that we just have to blindly take in. I'm saying the image represents the struggle of a certain period, which exists today in 2010 just the same. And while I've been thinking a lot about issues on race and racism and how people don't know how to articulate, you know, beyond, let's say, Blagojevich, who said, you know, that was stupid, stupid, stupid of me, and said stupid 17 times in 5 minutes with his interview to express himself or explain his racial faux pas that he was blacker than Obama. There are racism, you know, not only in the black and white communities, not only in the U.S., but as a kind of a global epidemic, it's everywhere. And stereotypes has to always be produced in order to maintain itself as a stereotype. It's sort of like the excessiveness proves it to be true, because you can't really prove a stereotype to be true, so it has to present itself in the most extreme forms and just an abundance of it. So you have stereotypes from, you know, dissemination on the internet to radical stereotypes that are created, you know, in certain images or the way a kind of a standard of the way we have to imagine Martin Luther King. So if we think of him as a stagnant image and we're comfortable mm-hmm. with his image, we are actually generating more stereotypes. He is symbolic of that period. But if we think of it as a live, living image and related to, like you have related with Haiti, the today, the embodied moment, then we understand that it is about everyday struggle and social justice. And it's about freedom. It's about freedom that applies not only to, you know, a moment in history, but freedom that, you know, crosses the border in terms of any forms of oppression, not only racism, sexism, but also sexism, ageism, classism, and you know, I see this existing everywhere. And to me, when I think about the image of Martin Luther King, I think of someone like Yu Kwan-sun, who was a revolutionary leader in Korea, who led the March 1st, 1919 rally demonstration, you know, from the Japanese colonization. And she was 19 years old, and she died, you know, at that age.
In that struggle?
Yes, in that struggle.
She was killed?
Yes. And she had walked from village to village, rallying people, Koreans, against the Japanese military. And so she's considered, you know, Joan of Arc of Korea. The nationalists calls her... the nationalists call her Yugwansun Nuna, which is sister, sort of like sister, you know? And so when we think of Yugwansun in this kind of blind nationalist manner, again, she's a stagnant image. But someone like Teresa Chakyong, who's an artist, Korean-American artist in the San Francisco Bay Area, working in the 70s, and she unfortunately was killed in the 80s in New York. She had written a text called Dictée about Yugwansun Nuna. And it was not an historic portrayal, but it was an embodied, situated portrayal of her, Joan of Arc, her mother, herself being interrogated. So all these different lives of women kind of coming together. And it's about the struggle of that moment. And the text is about that struggle. And she ties this with Dictée, the title meaning to speak, to come to speech, and also to be dictated by the moment of coming into being, the moment of coming into a form of language. So that kind of poetic, creative way of expressing an image of the past, I think, is... perhaps more real, and also the way in which I would like to think about Martin Luther King, because, you know, I wasn't around at that time, and I'm not an American citizen. So how, as a transnational body, let's say, you know, where my privilege is very situational, where I am, where I'm going, really dictates what kind of rights I have, you know, what is my right in the way in which I have to, you know, bear his image?
Yugwansun. Is that her name?
Yugwansun.
Yugwansun. Yugwansun. There's a lot to reflect on here, not just what I said, but everything that that Mina has just said.
Mina's dope. I'm sorry. She's really, really good. There's something really, really important as we reflect on this. If Martin Luther King Jr. were alive now, we actually don't know what he would have thought. We don't know where we have been politically, right? So part of this, for people who are critically engaged in both the life of the mind and in creating a better world, you know, on the ground, is about acknowledging, like, what we're doing is we are taking pieces and we're projecting, right? But he's not here, so we don't know. You know, it's possible he would have been really, really moderate. He would really moderate some of his views. But with that said, as Mina, one of the things that really struck me about what Mina talked about was the idea of representation. How do we create a representation that's alive? How do we take the various pieces of him and connect them both across space and then also back and forth in time, right? So how do we show, for example, that when he was actually asked to be involved in the Rosa Parks situation, he had to be dragged.
Right.
Right? It wasn't that he led that. People forced him. After they finally desegregated the bus situation, he actually wanted to stop. Right. And again, it was a group of people, largely black women, who literally browbeat him to continue. Right. So we take that piece at the beginning of his career. And he was so young, he barely had facial hair.
Right.
Right. We don't really understand how young he was.
Right.
And then at the end of his life, where he's really calling for civil disobedience. Right. So that's the cross time perspective. And then how do we connect that across space to other places, whether it's Brazil or South Africa or in Asia? Mm-hmm. That's what we have to do. And it's really, really challenging But that's the best way that those of us who are both interested in creating a better world and in getting people to critically engage can do it without deifying Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. then we can see his humanity. We could see that he was, you know, he sold people out too. There are all types of things he did which made him utterly human that we can bring back into the picture.
That's important. Yeah. It is important also about that, what you said about being, must have been like 25 years old, maybe 24 when...
Yeah,
when the bus boycott began,
he was a baby.
He was a baby.
Yeah,
I don't struggle so much over Martin Luther King's image. I think I kind of gave up on that one. Probably in the 90s, I was on a hunger strike in front of the Capitol steps.
That'll do it.
I was on the Capitol steps, and I do Latin America Latin America work, and I got accustomed to teachers when they were leading groups, delegations of students into the Capitol. Saying to their students, don't look at them, don't look at them, don't look at them. And I saw this one group of students approaching, and I saw a Che Guevara shirt in this field of students. I was like, yes! And I ran down, and I was like, hey, how you doing? Here's what we're doing out here. And it was Latin America related. It was Fast to Close the School of the Americas. And the guy had no idea why I was approaching him or who Che Guevara was and why he was on his shirt. And I was like, how did you get that shirt? And he was like, I bought it in a mall. It's a Rage Against the Machine shirt. I thought, you know, here's Rage Against the Machine. They've got a very powerful voice. They're very attractive for a lot of people, but they're not breaking through those barriers. But fortunately, Che has a legacy in words. You know, he's not just an image on a shirt. He's not just an image on a hat. He has a legacy in more than words. You know, there's a revolution that's still in place in Cuba that he helped build, and you know, he was a major piece of that. And Martin Luther King, I mean, you can say a lot about Martin Luther King, and we need to honor his memory and his legacy and his growth over the course of his activist career or his organizing career. And towards the end, I don't know how much he had to be brought into things kicking and screaming, but he was certainly making these mm-hmm. connections. He was going beyond looking simply for equality amongst races, and he was looking for more social justice. And he was taking stands against the Vietnam War. And I think he was bringing his philosophy of nonviolence and his understanding of power and how social change happens. Like, all of that stuff was evolving under King. And he was as massive a figure as he is in American history. He's one link in a long legacy of struggle. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people keeping that struggle up today and keeping that real, even if it's not necessarily in the image and name of Martin Luther King. And, you know, he acknowledged his successors. But and just locally in Baltimore... One of the groups that I'm working with is United Workers, and they have a direct legacy to Martin Luther King in terms of ideology and their struggle. They're part of another group, of a larger group, an umbrella group called the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, which is referential directly to Martin Luther King's call for the creation of a poor people's movement. Mm. And, you know, in leadership development and trainings and discourse, Martin Luther King, as well as Harriet Tubman, as well as Cesar Chavez, are all very present.
I mean, the King legacy is a difficult one. One of the reasons I wanted to have everybody in this room here was because the three of you were not aware of King then, obviously, but are really active and think a great deal now and are active in the life of a society and thinking about what it means, because there's a real gap. I mean, King, for me, I mean, I grew up with King and, you know, remember the day he was assassinated and also remember the fight that we had to make his birthday a holiday. And that was a struggle in America. Mm-hmm. People did not want to do it. And there was a whole bunch of us who just refused to work on his birthday just as a symbolic. Because it really is symbolic more than it's about... For us, it was more symbolic than it was about him. It was a symbolism of what that moment meant.
Sort of like the silence. The day of rest is keeping with the silence.
Right. It's become... Yeah, it should... This in some ways, to me, this should be a kind of a day of introspection, a day of quiet, a day of reflecting and talking.
Yeah.
You know, like any major spiritual religious holiday. That's what it should be for America, because it's about the transition from, to me, it's like the, not just what you all think about this when we come back from break. It's to me, it's the, it's like the, it is the transition from one America to another America, and that transitory battle and struggle is still among us. But that's what this symbolizes to me, and I'm going to talk about that when we come back from this very brief break. All right. We're joined here by Dr. Lester Spence, professor of political science at Hopkins, Mina Chon, who is a professor at MICA and an artist, Mike McGuire, who's co-founder of Red Emmons Bookstore and Coffee House Cafe. Stay with us as we explore a bit more about what this day does mean to all of us. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm here in the studio on this Martin Luther King Day. We're recording here on Friday on his 81st birthday. Reflecting on Martin Luther King and, of course, this tragedy happening in Haiti and where the world is now and the world in constant struggle here on this planet, maybe in a more intense way than before in history, just because the world is in such deep communication with one another around the globe all the time. We can't get away from each other. Dr. Lester Spence is in the studio. He's professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. You hear him on the Barbershop Group on Tell Me More here on WEAA. You can read his writings and thoughts at lesterspence.com and hear him often here on The Mark Steiner Show. Mina Chon is with us, who will be back on the show soon as soon as I finish reading her book, Shamanism in Cyberspace. She's an artist and a writer, interdisciplinary professor at Maryland Institute College of Art. She will be the keynote speaker on the 20th this month on Unity Day, speaking on racism at MICA. Mike McGuire is with us. He's co-founder of Red Emma's Bookstore and Coffee House, activist working with United Workers and witness against torture, and makes his living as a carpenter. So as we went to break, I was thinking about this idea of the symbolism of King as at a point where the different Americas were in battle for America, and all of a sudden this world of America, to me, in my perspective, came from bubbling up from underneath the bowels of this country, and black folks in the South started the war to change, to end segregation, and that began to change things. America had this mythology about it, and I always thought that America's mythology was like torn asunder in the 50s and 60s from you know, the America being a white nation to America's, to George Washington chopping down the cherry tree. All the mythology was cracked open, and I always felt that nothing ever really replaced it. And every culture and nation and peoplehood need their mythology as kind of guides to the future. And so King's represented to me this the day is like representing this the continuing kind of battle for the American soul of who we are and what that represents. I mean, you know, after that was the bubbling up of the women's movement, the Native American movement, the Puerto Rican Young Lords, you know, the Brown Berets in the Mexican community. That all came coming up. The environmental movement was born in 1970 out of this. All these kind of different worlds and different views kind of bubbled up and mushroomed up out of that 1960s cauldron. And King's death symbolizes that to me. And I'm curious how you all reflect on that, because you all were born and came of age after all that. And what that says to you about where we are now. Anybody can jump in. And just jump in all around. I don't care. Mina, go ahead.
Kirk Fuos is a scholar in theater and performance studies. And he wrote, there's this quote he wrote about the theater and violence of lynching. Is thinking about...
What's his name again?
Kirk Fuos.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's thinking about how you could rethink about history and the way in which lynching occurred through looking at the performative elements that hyped up that moment. It's a really kind of radical article. But he says there is no before racism in America, and unfortunately, there is no after racism. And when I think of the monstrosities of violence and the kind of physical manifestation that we see that signals these grand gestures of violence and racism, as example, with lynching or segregation or even those signs that says, you know, no black man allowed in a certain area or things that we could all point to today and say, that's really racist. You know, as much as those occurrences are so violent and monstrous and just big in their gesture, the activism that follows it is always just as grand. The marching, the activism, and this is where I say the activism with the capital A. And it refers to the conversation that artists have about art with a capital A versus art with a small A. And art with a small A is the art that you have everyday life, the kind of art that goes unnoticed, but that's always working. It's at work. So activism with the big A is great in gesture, and it's pronounced. And it's very important because that's what we remember. But it comes together with the implicit forms of activism. And I think that's something that we could today kind of reflect on. What is your activism for the day that remembers Martin Luther King? And you and Mark, you had mentioned today is a day of contemplation. That's real activism. It's activism at work. And we don't have to have a great big celebration, although symbolically it resonates to make a big gesture. But I think the everyday, let's not forget him tomorrow. Let's not forget the meaning of human struggle when it comes to oppression, because oppression really comes not only explicitly, but in these kind of very implicit forms that goes unnoticed. And I always see it more and more with technology booming, that the internet has created more stereotypes by replaying out old prejudices, you know. And for a very simple example, you know that pointer that we see on the internet when we link something? I always wonder, you know, why does it have to be white? Why does it have to be a white point, a white hand? How come no one's addressing it? And
maybe it's wearing a glove.
Well, that's what I thought, too. I thought that is a Michael Jackson glove. It's just artificial, like the internet. No, but really, I think what we don't really discuss, and I'd like to always be able to discuss this with my students, my colleagues, is this construction of the enemy. You know, if Martin Luther King's image is of the good, right, and it's grand, it's this special, it's this important, there is going to be that oppositional construction of the enemy face. And it's transferred from the boogeyman, the Arab man, the black face, the Asian face. And it just, you know, it might not be as big, but it's everywhere. And this construction is fed over and over again, you know, by the media, by the government.
So I attended the University of Michigan for undergraduate and grad school. And in 1988, January of 1988, we basically took over the university and we made them take MLK Day off. We literally encircled school buildings, and people had to make a choice. They had to walk through us to get to class, right? So the university responded by acceding to our demand, but instead of calling it MLK Day, they called it Diversity Day, right?
This is Michigan 1988.
Michigan 1989, it was Diversity Day. And we were like, no, this is not Diversity Day, right? Because we understood that the rhetoric of diversity was really apolitical. Mm-hmm. It was MLK Day. I created T-shirts with MLK, with MLK's image on it, with Diversity Day, with the Diversity Day, diversity crossed out MLK, put above that. As a result of student movements, and that's connected to a long history of student movements in Michigan had the largest MLK Day celebration in North America at one point, the University of Michigan. Right? We brought in speakers from a wide range of ideological perspectives, from your liberal to integrationists to nationalists. We brought in Khalid Muhammad, I remember. You know, we brought in Alex Haley. We brought in people who were involved in the Native American struggle. And it was just, it was like for that one day, for that one period, the University of Michigan embodied anti-racism. Right. And it was just it was like astounding. But then over time, you know, and it still exists now in a different way. But over time, that institution, there's like a new institutional equilibrium. Right. And there's this there's a new racism where, yeah, you still have this MLK Day thing, but it's kind of been neutered of its politics. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. our challenge is in this moment is to take is to really work on somehow institutionalizing struggle. Right. So where we change institutions like the University of Michigan in higher ed or like Johns Hopkins, where I'm at now, or we change institutions like the city of Baltimore, a larger institution. Right. But at the same time, we recognize that once that change occurs, you know, once we get a black mayor, for example, right, that that's not the ending. That's the beginning. Right. So then when something happens like what happened to the mayor, you know, when she ends up having to step down because she, you know, she took money inappropriately, where we can take that moment and say, OK, well, this is 2.0. So 1.0 was creating a mechanism where we could get blacks elected to office. Right. And we did that. It was important. And we did it. But 2.0 is like, OK, so how do we create a mechanism where our black representatives are engaged in the struggle to create a better world? Because just because they're black doesn't mean they're necessarily revolutionary or mm-hmm. radical, right? Or even liberal, mm-hmm. right?
Fair enough.
Yeah, so that's what we have to somehow do. And conversations like this are the perfect first perfect step, but we have to somehow create more spaces like this. And that's where the contemplative element comes in, right? Where we're getting together like, well, okay, this world is very different than the world of 1988 even, right? Mm-hmm. In some ways, America is now anti-racist principles have become the norm. That's why MLK is such a standard, right? I mean, he wouldn't be a standard if somehow right. we didn't embody that, right? But that isn't enough, right? How do we take this step and build on it to create a better place? To what's the next step of institutional change? What does that look like?
I actually want to go back to the point that you or the question that you were asking, Mark, and I wonder if that mythology and narrative of the United States that existed before the Civil Rights Movement has disappeared at all or any more than it did exist. Mm-hmm. And I think that the narrative you're talking about is the narrative of white America, and no. white America still has that narrative. And I'm not sure black America or Hispanic America, for lack of a better word, but Latino America. I'm not sure that narrative ever really existed for those communities more then than now or what. I think we've always had many narratives, and I think more narratives have come up since then. But and myself working in construction, largely in the white community, that narrative is predominant. I mean, overwhelming. America is George Washington, and abroad, when people speak of America, they largely speak of white America. Like that's what people think of when they think of America. So I don't think it's so diminished. But I think one of the things that's dangerous is that I think that vision of America as being the greatest country in the world, as being the most generous country in the world, I think that is clearly bound for collapse. And it's actually for a few years, it's actually worried me. Like, what's going to happen to all these people when America isn't the America that they think it is, and they know it because we're not on top of the world? You know, for so many people, the identification is America is number one. And if we're number two or number three, what happens to that consciousness?
Mike, thanks for bringing us back to the question. So let me quickly. So when we took over Michigan, right, we had this idea that the University of Michigan was a white school, even though I'm a Detroiter, you know, pay taxes, Michigan resident at the time. Michigan is my school. So what we had to do that day was take it back, right? Mm-hmm. And what I'd suggest is that there is this narrative, and what we have to do is act, what we're in the process of doing is creating a new narrative. And there's tension because we've got this story that has all these political consequences, and then our counterparts, I wouldn't say our enemies, but our counterparts have this other dominant story, the one that's been responsible for oppressing us. That story is in the process of changing, and it's through contemplation and it's through recognizing that we're in the midst of a story that's changing that we can in turn move that narrative into a direction that's better for all of us.
I think it's really important to keep that rigor of discussion, and that it needs to happen all platforms. The kind of simplicity that is required today to produce anything in media, you know, the 30-second sound bites of, you know, any topic and the, attention span for that is all sort of playing against the rigor that needs to be constantly applied when we are dealing with, you know, ideas and just living history that is already so complicated. And last fall, I remember Angela Davis was at MICA. And, you know, obviously there was a cheering crowd. It was Constitution Day. And she had said something that just sits with me forever. She said, you know, when it comes to women's liberation, it's not, you know, the fact that there's more female CEOs or, you know, a supposed or possible, you know, president that could have been. You know, you have to look at, you know, has there been change, you know, in the worst possible situation for women? You know, and she mentioned women in prison. How are they treated? So you can't look at, you can't measure success or women's liberation just by, you know, a couple of case stories, a couple of the success stories. So going back to what you're saying, okay, so neutering this idea of MLK is problematic. One thing, when we say that the call for freedom and recognizing violence and different levels of oppression is worldwide, is different than sort of homogenizing the situation of diverse, you know, oppression and struggles into one big clunk and naming it diversity. There is a difference there. And without that kind of rigorous, you know, analysis or just even trying to figure out what that difference is and how it's different, we're, you know, mistakenly going to clunk it together and call it multiculturalism. Or, you know, let's get rid of MLK Day and replace it with, you know, the Unity Day. Sorry. No, although that is not what MICA is doing.
You sure?
No, because it's in celebration. It's Unity Week. So it's MICA has extended it. Week-long celebration. No, but I think it's actually very, very important to be able to continuously keep the dialogue in its rigorous form. And in a way, Haiti was a wake-up call because, you know, prior to that, we were seeing Blagojevich and Reed and, you know, this media sensation. It was very short. It was, you know, the comments were short or, you know, the response, like I said, the word stupid as the only way to address race and racism. You know, it's just more of it, but they're very short sound bites. Mark, you being, you know, someone in this field, an expert in this field, how do you address that? How do you deal with trying to articulate and converse on very complicated issues, you know, and diversifying that with every conversation rather than truncating it into a single sound bite?
It's not easy. I just turned the tables on me. I should do the interviewing. It's my.
I'm just so Mina, curious.
The Mina Chun show.
No, I'm sorry.
No, it's cool. I'm just
Mina's dope. Mina's dope.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that what you all have been talking about here, when we as we kind of reflect on this Martin Luther King Day, is that on the one hand, you can't talk about America without talking about race and racism. They're just a part of one another. On the other hand, not only the other hand, but also you, it's all how you approach things. We talk here a lot about this. I mean, that if you, let's say we're talking about the world of parallel universes that may or may not exist. And you have mathematicians and physicists and others and philosophers contemplating this notion of parallel universes. I just raise that because it's one of my favorite things to think about. So if you have that discussion, what becomes important to me besides the discussion are the voices that talk about the parallel universes. So when you have a conversation about parallel universes, you take the effort to go find an African-American philosopher, scientist, mathematician to weigh in on, not as a black man or woman, mm-hmm. not as a Mexican-American black man or woman, or as a Korean-American man or woman, but as a thinker who happens to be that thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the discussions you have begin to reflect America on a broader intellectual plane, on a broader social plane, a broader thoughtful plane. So the conversation. So then, to me, that whittles down racist contexts in people's heads over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
That's as important sometimes, or even more important than talking about just race mm-hmm. and racism.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have come to a place. I mean, what you were saying, you know, a little bit. Let's reflect on this for a few minutes. I mean, when people think of America, they think of white America, you said. And let's challenge that for a minute. I'm not sure that's true. I mean, I think that what has happened in the world, that's part of what America looks like in the rest of the world. I think the part of it is that people love America because of its foundation of liberty and freedom from its documentary roots, Constitution, Bill of Rights, Articles of Confederation, that people have a vision of America of that way as well. And I think one of the most powerful cultures on the planet Earth that has infused the planet everywhere you go is the African-American culture. The African diasporic culture has transformed culture on the planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some things I think about on King Day, mm-hmm. too. You know?
There's no doubt about that. But I've had these conversations in Latin America, and people have said, but that's not the real America.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the seat of power in America.
Mm.
You know, that's cultural production in America.
But real and power are different things.
Yeah.
Real and power
mm-hmm.
can be different things.
But also in terms of perception, because I do have the foreigner's perspective as well, I think England, for example, you know, is more related with the white. America, more so with capital mm-hmm. America. And the American dream has been the association. And I think it's so important that we don't just, again, clunk all race, you know, sex, gender. We don't clunk it all into this one universal, everyone's the same, which ends up being a global village rant, right? but that we understand why there is representation when it's had. It is a call for activism. You are placing the representation as a kind of advocacy for a struggle, not saying that essentially because I am African American or because I'm Asian, that embodies me to be a certain way. I think it's really important to remove ourselves from thinking this essentialist thinking. Not all African Americans or black people are going to have Martin Luther King in them. They are not born of that, right? Just the same, we could say that a foreigner who does not live in America can agree to the ideas of Martin Luther King. It works both ways. I mean, we can't just say you have to be black in order to appreciate blackness. Because then it raises the question, you know, and the stereotype, you're not black enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lester, why don't you leap in here?
Yeah, Albert Murray wrote a book that really influenced me. It's called The Omni-American. And before reading that book, I was moving more towards a view of America being something different. But after reading that book, I it really transformed how I thought about America. So America was in me, right? So I started to really think about America as being fundamentally black, right? And that through historical, not really a historical accident, but through because of history, right? Because Africans were enslaved, right? Once they were brought over, it's that group of people that fundamentally changed democracy, and then other groups follow, right? That fundamental change that creates American culture, and then other people contribute, right? So I actually see us now in that process. So when Obama, when we have a black man as president, and there are all types of kids who are growing up with that image, well, wow, the president is black, right? And that changes things irrevocably, right? On the racial / cultural axis. So the challenge for me now is really about how do we take that class conception of America, right? That America means a certain type of consumption. It means having a certain type of house. It means having a certain type of, you know, a certain amount of money and striving for that, right? Against other people. How do we begin in all these different communities, in the black community, in the Latino community, in the community of transnationals? How do we actually change that conception through this changing conception of America as being more than white, right? And that'll once we do that, I think that will begin, you know, the whites who are struggling, who feel out of place in this new America, they'll be able to find their place again.
On two levels, yeah. That is where America is going to be struggling, that I think that to try to redefine itself in terms of race. I always like to say to people sometimes that if you're American, you are black.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's a different way of thinking about who we are, and start bubbling up, creating conversation. Well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, and I think when we're talking about having a black man as president of the United States, I think that a lot of people who make a mistake, at least from my perspective, when they criticizing Obama for what he does or doesn't do, is that let's not confuse the symbolic power of having somebody black in the White House,
exactly.
Yes,
right.
With
yeah.
the substance of what that means or doesn't mean.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's yeah. on this first Martin Luther King Day with a black president. All right. And then the question is, you want to close this out? We only have about a couple minutes
left. Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, I came to Baltimore and I came to America in 97. And I had lived, you know, outside of the U.S. in different countries, you know, more than half my life, of course, in Korea. So I'm Korean, citizenship-wise. But I've been feeling very American, you know, not because my Korean friends in Korea say, you are so American, but because I'm part of the discussion.
You are?
And I sort of forced myself in the beginning from an outsider. I shamelessly decided to be part of the discussion.
Good.
You know, and that I think maybe, you know, if there is an America that we'd like to be, it's that it allows this.
Folks, I think we've come down to the bottom of the hour here, or the top of the hour, however we call it. It's been a great discussion. You'll see Dr. Lester Spence and hear him on Tell Me More. Go to lesterspence.com, and he'll be here often on this program. Always good to see Dr. Spence.
Hey, good to see you. Really good to see you. My man. My man.
It's great to meet Nina Chun. I mean, second time, but have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
And you can hear, if you want to, at the Unity Day. She'll be speaking on racism at 2:30 on January the 20th at MICA, correct? And we'll be back on the show to talk about her book, Shamanism in Cyberspace. Mike McGuire, great to meet you. Good to have you. We've met before, but not like this. It's mm-hmm. good to have you.
We have,
studio.
Actually. This is my third time on.
The third time on the show. Mm-hmm. As co-founder of Red Emma's Bookstore, and you can just wander into him there as well. Thank you all so much, and let's think about reflecting on this Martin Luther King Day for the rest of the evening that you have and for some time on. And folks, thank you for being here. Happy MLK Day.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.